What does an inner-city motel have in common with Airbnb? Or Stanford University have in common with a midlife wisdom school? One thing. Chip Conley. Conley, who gained a reputation as a rebel hotelier and industry disruptor during his 2.5 decades as the owner of Joie de Vivre, the second largest boutique hotel chain in the United States, is also author of numerous bestsellers, a much sought-after speaker, and a board member of the Burning Man Project. Now, how cool is that? With accolades and success in hand, Conley decided to retire in 2010 at the age of 49. Now what? The answer appeared in the form of 3 20-somethings who approached him to join their company as head of global hospitality and strategy and mentor to their CEO, Brian Chesky. You may be familiar with them. Airbnb. Conley's journey from running his own company to re-entering the workforce in an unfamiliar industry and realizing he was no longer the sage on the stage gave him the opportunity to reframe his experience and identity. Today, we're going to explore with him exactly what that meant to him and why it inspired him to write the book Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, while at the same time laying the foundation for his new venture, the Modern Elder Academy, which, by the way, is the first midlife wisdom school dedicated to transforming aging. So let's get the conversation started, shall we? Welcome to Colin Milner Rethinks Aging with Chip Conley.
Colin, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
Many people have experienced a Bahama breeze, but few a Baja aha. Can you share with our listeners how your Baja aha inspired the concept of a midlife wisdom school dedicated to transforming aging?
I was writing the book Wisdom at Work, The Making of a Modern Elder, down here where I have a home on the beach in Baja. And it was on a run down the beach one day where I had a Baja aha. I had an epiphany where I really sort of started thinking about the fact that we have absolutely no schools, tools, rites of passage, or rituals for people in midlife and beyond to understand how to go through and navigate their midlife and later transitions. It's like DIY, do it yourself. And so that came to me on that run. And then I actually thought about my experience at Airbnb, which I would join the company in early 2013, and I was twice the age of the average employee. I really felt like an outcast. I was a lovely outcast in the sense that lovable outcast. I don't know lovely, but I was a lovable outcast in that the 3 founders asked me to join. So I wasn't just some 52-year-old trying to get a job with the company, which would have been hard because generally speaking, there is a lot of ageism in the tech world. But I was able to sort of start seeing the importance of how do you marry young, brilliant technologists with wise generalists, people who have some experience under their belt. And maybe that's the future of the organizational world. About 40% of America has a boss that's younger than them. And by the year 2025, that's expected to be the majority of Americans. So how do we help microwave the emotional intelligence and leadership skills of young, especially digital leaders? And maybe it's partly by marrying them with modern elders who are as curious as they are wise. So that was another reason it came up. And then the third thing, it was like I had 5 friends commit suicide during the Great Recession. And they were all men in midlife. 3 of them were entrepreneurs. And I really wished that they had had some kind of course, there's all kinds of programs for people who are contemplating suicide. But there's not really sort of mainstream programs that help people to understand the process of shifting into midlife and beyond. So I think in some ways I created MEA for that reason, because I wanted to make sure that people felt like there was a great support. The idea of expanding it to something more than just a little academy here on the beach in Baja has really been grown by our community, or of our 1,000 people who've gone through the program, who when we did the beta part of the program, the first thing people said was, well, where's your alumni program? This is my alma mater now. I was like, great, if we're your alma mater, we're open to having you write us a check. Which is what alma maters are always asking for, right?
Of course. And with that check comes the school crest that can be sewn in your jacket, right?
Exactly. I mean, there was some truth to that too, because we're a social enterprise. So over 50% of the people who come to MEA are on a scholarship from us. Wisdom is not taught, it's shared. And so if you're sitting around with 18 or 20 people in a workshop and you don't have a diverse group of people there of all kinds of folks, a fireman next to a retired CEO, next to a nurse, next to a successful doctor who doesn't want to do it anymore, you create a much richer conversation. And really what we specialize is in the kind of deeper conversations people want to have in midlife and beyond. So expanding that beyond just being here in Mexico made sense. And then COVID actually sort of accelerated this by saying, we need to be in a location in the US for our first location where people could even drive to if they wanted to.
Charles Darwin said, it's not the strongest of the species that survives, not the most intelligent that survives. It's the one that is the most adaptable to change. So how have you adapted or changed what the Academy offers during COVID-19?
All of us are being forced into decisions and trying to tap into wisdom and maybe even a fortune teller to help us understand how to operate our businesses. We had to really scratch our head and say, are we going to stay open? What are we going to do? We closed for basically 6.5, almost 7 months. Over that time, I wrote a white paper called The Emergence of Long Life Learning, which is different than lifelong learning. So long life learning speaks to how do you create a life that's as deep and meaningful as it is long. And the way a person learns at age 65 is different than how they learn at age 35. So lifelong learning is the overall umbrella, but someone who's interested in long life learning is interested in the kinds of things that are important to you, maybe post 50 years old or later. So we've actually been in the process of working with universities and colleges to look at how they expand their education programs for people in midlife and beyond. Secondly, we created our own MEA online program. So we now actually do the MEA workshop program in an 8-week course with what we call digital intimacy. So you're in a cohort of 8 people. And there's sometimes we have everybody in a course at the same time, but most of it's with your collection of 8 people. And you do some one-on-one dyads with someone else in your group each week. And that's been successful. So we did reopen our MEA Baja campus in October, but instead of doing our very physically and emotionally intimate workshops, which didn't feel appropriate for the COVID times, we created something called sabbatical sessions, which allows people to come for an extended stay. They come for a minimum of 2 weeks, but on average, they're coming for a month or longer. And we have a light level of programming. Everything's done outdoors, which is fortunate about being in a tropical climate. And it's been very popular. It's been a nice way for us to have a bridge to when we can start doing workshops again. And then finally, and while I can't talk about the details yet, we are going to be creating our first US MEA regenerative community, which is an alternative to a retirement community. The dictionary definition of regenerative versus retirement, it will tell you that retirement is about going into seclusion and withdrawing, and regenerative is about actually regenerating yourself. And there's even an agriculture term now called regenerative farming. We're doing that, which will have an MEA campus, a farm, as well as residences, homes, both for rent and for sale. So we will be coming to a market near you soon enough, because we really do believe that MEA could be to the 21st century regenerative community what Sun City was to the 20th century retirement community. What we know is a lot of people in midlife and beyond want to have a different experience than often what they consider to be the retirement community experience that their parents have had.
Have you thought about bringing some of these concepts to high schools?
I think there are great opportunities to create mutual mentorship between older and younger people in the school system, even younger than high school, because what we know is that young people and older people have a lot to learn from each other.
Such as?
No one takes a class called Emotions 101. The only person who teaches it to you is your parent or parents. And frankly, they're usually not very good teachers. They're not role models. And so I think if I were to change the education system, I think one of the key things I would try to change is the fact that helping people to be more fluent about their emotions, would be good, especially young boys and men.
Let's hone in on this topic of mentorship for a moment. When you were younger, did you have a specific mentor or mentors who helped shape who you are today?
Yeah, I'll give you two. One is my father. I hate to use that example because it's so obvious. But my dad was a mentor to me, even though I really struggled with him. I am Stephen Townsend Conley Jr., a chip off the old block. And I am so different than my dad. And I'm the only boy in the family, the children. I got two younger sisters, so I'm the oldest. And so my dad was a tough father. He was a Marine captain. I really rebelled against him. But at the end of the day, he had an impact on me. When I was a relatively new CEO of my company in my mid to late 20s, I reached out to have somebody become my mentor from afar. This is a great story because it shows you that your mentor doesn't have to be somebody you know. So I was growing Joie de Vivre, my boutique hotel company, and the company that I most admired for its culture was Southwest Airlines. So I reached out to Herb Kelleher, who was at that time, this is like 1991 or 92, I think.
Okay, hang on. You reached out to the CEO of Southwest Airlines. There's got to be some cojones there.
I guess so. You just didn't even know it was like unheard of. But what I did was I called Dallas. I called Southwest Airlines headquarters. I mean, this is a day when, back in the day when you'd call someplace and someone would answer. And
hi, I want to speak to Herb.
Well, what I did is I said, could I speak to Herb's executive assistant? I'd done my research and her name was Colleen Barrett. And so I got Colleen Barrett on the phone, who was his legal secretary, then became his executive assistant. And I told her my story. And I said, listen, at that point, I was in my early 30s and I have this company that's growing fast. I love the Southwest culture. I would love Herb to be my mentor. And she laughed just like I am right now. And she said, well, Herb probably can't do it. He's a pretty busy guy. But if you write him a letter, and if he really likes it, he might take a letter from you once a year. And once a year, you write him a letter and you just ask three or four questions and then he'll respond to it. So I did that. And 3 weeks later, after I sent it, I get this letter back from Kelleher saying to me, answering my questions about culture and about leadership and about things like that. So I call Colleen back and I say, oh my God, he responded to me. She says, he's like that. He'll do that. And he liked what you wrote him. Write us again in another year. So every year for 10 years, I wrote Herb Kelleher. And here's the part that's amazing, Colin. Herb was so good at understanding talent and seeing culture in an organization that he groomed his executive assistant to become the president of Southwest Airlines.
So what did you learn from him?
What I learned is that you have to invest in culture. So what I loved about Southwest is here's this low-price airline with absolutely the best service. That doesn't make sense. And it's not just the service, it's just the friendliness. United may say they have the friendly skies, but Southwest said you had the freedom to fly and the freedom to actually have their flight attendants just be themselves, which was an unheard of concept back then because everybody else was so scripted. And so I appreciated the frivolity of it. So he just told me how they invested in culture. They had these cultural ambassadors where the culture of the company was democratized in essence. It wasn't just the HR department figuring it out. It was everybody in the company figuring it out. I mean, it's a much longer story, and I've written a little bit about it in one of my books called Peak, How Great Companies Get Their Mojo from Maslow. But yeah, it was a great experience to get to know him. So I guess the lesson for all of us is sometimes you can reach out to someone you don't know, and they may not be your day-to-day or week-to-week mentor, but they may be willing to answer some questions.
The lesson is pick up the phone.
Yeah.
When did you realize you wanted to become an entrepreneur?
As a teenager, I tried creating a bunch of businesses. I mean, obviously tiny businesses. And I realized I appreciated the creativity of what it meant to be an entrepreneur. I never have liked rules. As I said earlier, I was a bit of a rebel with my dad. And so the idea of creating a business and then choosing the rules you want to create or even not create was liberating for me. And I think it also gave me the opportunity to see what worked and didn't at a relatively young age. Those experiences gave me the opportunity to say, okay, I want to become an entrepreneur someday. And so I took a job out of business school when most people are MBA, Stanford Business School. People make a fortune. I took a job out of Stanford Business School in 1984 for $2,000 a month. And I took it because I was going to go work for a maverick real estate developer in San Francisco who did very creative projects. And he couldn't really afford to pay me a lot. And I just wanted to learn from him and his company. And so for 2.5 years, I became a partner in the company. And for 2.5 years, I did that. And I learned a lot. I learned, frankly, a lot of things that I didn't want to emulate as well. And that led me to starting my company on basically my 26th birthday. It's not just the cojones or the confidence. There's a sense of like, I had a pretty good intuition, a good merchant sense. And when you have a merchant sense, you sort of have a sense of how do you make money? And in my case, how do you make money with incorporating some meaning in the process? So it's not just about going and making money. It's also how do you make a difference in the world? And how do you help create meaning in people's lives, especially our employees?
What does the future hold for Chip Conley?
What's meaningful for me is to be a pioneer. And that goes back to my rebellious childhood. I was one of the first boutique hoteliers in the U.S., so I was a disruptor, so to speak, to the traditional hotel chains. At Airbnb, of course, I was a disruptor. That company still is a disruptive company and controversial sometimes as well. But generally speaking, it's now the most valuable travel company in the world. And valuation-wise, worth twice what Marriott, the biggest hotel company in the world, is worth. So I appreciated the fact that I spent 8 years helping that company become what it has become. But once again, I was a disruptor. The MEA idea was to create midlife wisdom schools, but it was really just a school and an academy. That was it. And it was meant to be a pioneering thing, maybe disrupting higher education on some level. The direction we're going now and what's my future, and I really feel like is my next 20 years from age 60 to 80, because I think about age 80, I may retire. I don't know. I'll slow down about 20 years from now. My thinking is the number one thing I can be a pioneer on right now is senior living. And when I say senior living, I even don't love that term because it sort of gives a point of view that someone is older than the demographic I'm talking about. Our average age of who comes to MEA has been 54. About 75% of the people are 45 to 65, but we've had people from 30 to 88. Come to MEA to cultivate and harvest their wisdom. I would like to be a pioneer of regenerative communities where we regenerate the soil, we help regenerate the soul of the people who come to our workshops and live in the community. We generate a sense of community, which is something that people are desperate for today, not just because of COVID. COVID's a huge part of it, but even pre-COVID, there was a real desire for community, but not just sort of like superficial community, but more deeper community. And then a regeneration of the locale. Because one of the challenges with a lot of retirement communities is they're basically a bunker. They're sort of age apartheid. I'm stealing from Mark Friedman on that one. A movie that's just coming out. What's it called? Some Kind of Heaven, about the villages. It's a fascinating documentary about the idea of creating that cocoon. And the thing that I think we really need is something that's much more permeable. And so that there's a little bit of an intergenerational component to it. There's an ability to actually create an impact in the local community. So we want to regenerate soil, soul, community, and the locale. And those are our four ways that we see a regenerative community existing. And it's sort of going from being a conventional idea to an intentional idea, meaning the people who choose to be there are not there because it's the warehouse for where you go when you go out to pasture. But it's the place where you choose your community based upon the intention of what that community's ethos is. And most senior living communities don't have an ethos that sort of back it up. More and more so they are. I'm a real estate person. Let's start by that. So I'm going to say something that's a bit of an indictment of real estate. And real estate takes a long time. Bricks and mortar, it's a tough business. It's very hard to be innovative in bricks and mortar because bricks and mortar don't just change when you're whimsical. Airbnb can change its website and then decide, okay, 6 months from now, it's going to be changed. Any of these big companies, they can't go do that. But what they have to do is they have to start moving the ship in a new direction. Otherwise, they're just going to keep going in that same direction. And we're going to see a declining demand for what feels like senior living community. And so if I can help pioneer the idea of what does a regenerative community look like for the future, that would be a great legacy.
Over the years, I've learned that behind every creative concept and innovative idea is a curious person, someone looking for better ways of doing things. How has curiosity impacted what you have achieved?
Oh man, what a great question, Colin. Curiosity is probably, I have a bunch of things I'm not very good at. Let's start by that. But curiosity is one of my superpowers. I am fascinated by life and things. And one of my role models for that is a guy named Peter Drucker. Now, I've never met Peter Drucker, quite famous management theorist. But for those who don't know him, he pretty much created the science of management and leadership.
And kicked it off in Japan, of all places.
Kicked it off in Japan. And he's the one who actually coined the term knowledge workers in 1959. He said the world will be ruled by knowledge workers. No one had any idea what he was talking about because most people had never seen a computer before. And the computers were the things in these big rooms that like you would never could imagine you'd have a computer sitting on your lap or in your palm of your hand. So Peter Drucker was quite prescient, a real forecaster. Now, he wrote 2/3 of his 40 books after the age of 65. But the reason I bring him up around curiosity is because I have emulated something that he used to do. Every 2 years, he would study a topic that he knew nothing about, but he was passionately curious about that topic, and he wanted to become one of the world's leading experts. So it was everything from Japanese ikebana, like flower arranging, to medieval war strategies. And so he felt like curiosity was the elixir of life, and it lubricated the heart, the mind, the soul. And in many ways, what I've said publicly is I think curiosity is the fuel for creativity and innovation. So if a company wants to figure out how to become more creative and innovative, and what company doesn't want to do that, then actually, how are you stoking the coals of curiosity? Because that's actually what leads to creativity and innovation. It's a deeply embedded part of what we do at MEA. We use something called appreciative inquiry. You can Google appreciative inquiry and learn more about it. But it's a way of asking questions that open up possibilities. So yes, thank you for that question, because I love being curious.
How important is curiosity in mid and latter life?
I've studied curiosity a lot. I almost decided to write a book on it. So curiosity is interesting because it's so important in mid and later life. What happens in mid and later life often is there's a shutting down. There's a narrowing of your life. I'm not saying it has to happen, but it does happen for a lot of people. And part of it's because of what's called a fixed mindset. When you have a fixed mindset, you tend to only do things that you can do well. And then we also know about fixed mindset of just being cranky and just like not wanting to learn anything new. And so if that's what happens, your sandbox gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So curiosity is the opposite of that, and it leads to what's called a growth mindset. And if you have a growth mindset, you're not focusing on winning, you're focusing on learning. And the value in that is it opens up possibilities. So what curiosity does is it helps you to ask yourself, what would that be like? It opens up the possibility of things that you might not have done otherwise. So the question I tend to ask is the following. When someone's feeling stuck and not very curious, or feeling like, you know what, I don't want to learn anything new. It's like, okay, there's someone I was talking about this with the other day. They're 58 years old, and they're sort of in a place where they're no longer curious. I'm not so interested in learning anything new. Okay, so I asked them, well, how long are you going to live to? And he said, 98. And I said, do you understand that at age 58, and if you're going to live till 98, you're exactly at halftime of your adult life if you start counting at age 18. And when the look on his face, I wish I had a video of the look on his face, when he just had a moment of awakening of like, oh my God, I'm only halfway through my adult life. And I'm pretty much just going to play golf the rest of my life. Because this is a guy who retired a year or two earlier. And as we've learned, frankly, and this is a sad fact, that retirement has been proven to accelerate your mortality by 2 years, which doesn't make any sense because like you have all this extra space, but often you don't have a sense of purpose. Often you don't have a sense of community like you did when you were working. And often you lose your sense of wellness, which doesn't make sense. Like why would you lose your health when you have more time? Because you don't have the discipline and structure. And without the discipline and structure, yes, you have a lot more time, but you know what? You're not as disciplined about going to the gym or going for a walk. Even though you've got the time, people don't realize what percentage of their adult life they still have ahead of them. You introduce them to that concept and they start to say, wow, okay. If they don't have any tools or resources to help them with it, frankly, what I've seen is people just get a little bit scared and sad because they realize, oh my God, I'm just going to sort of be a couch potato for the next 40 years.
As you say, Chip, curiosity is vital. But let's pivot for a moment and talk about wisdom workers. What are wisdom workers and why do we need them?
Peter Drucker talked about knowledge workers. I think it's time we introduce the phrase wisdom workers. And we need wisdom workers because wisdom workers are the people, who, like I was at Airbnb, who help to be the generalist to connect the dots. One of the things that a lot of people don't know is that as we get older, yes, we all know that your memory goes away, not quite as good as it used to be. Your speed actually slows down in terms of your mental acuity. But what a lot of people don't know, those are both negatives, I guess. But what people don't know about is the positive about what happens with your brain over time is you learn to do the left brain, right brain tango. You get better at doing four-wheeler drive all over your brain and thinking what is called synthetically and with crystallized intelligence. To make that in layperson's terms, you know how to connect the dots. You think holistically. You think systemically. Why is that valuable? That's another way of saying wisdom. You actually can sort of see something, whereas a young brain is exceptionally focused. And wisdom workers, modern elders, are the kinds of people who can help young people, not because you say, this is the way it's always been, and you tell your own war stories for 5 hours. No, because you're actually the person who's a first-class noticer, and you're observing things, and you can sort of say, well, here's the pattern I'm seeing. Because wisdom is all about pattern recognition. And the longer you've been on this planet, the more patterns you've seen.
What patterns are you seeing that we need to pay attention to?
A pattern pre-COVID was loneliness. In a world where social media and the internet was supposed to make us closer, there's rampant loneliness. Death by despair is a real thing in America. The suicide rate for people 45 to 64 is 50% higher than it was in the year 2000. I hear a lot the word community, and then I always want to ask the person, okay, let's drill down on it. What do you mean by that? But I do think that that's going to be a growing topic, and it's been talked about for a long time. What I think there's a growing need for is for people to have the recognition that, as Carl Jung, the famous psychologist, said, the operating system for the first half of our adult life is our ego, and for the second half of our life is our soul. So what that means is that people are looking for deep and meaningful connection with the world and with themselves. Often I see the sort of the way we market to older people is showing a YouTube video of a 95-year-old woman who's doing yoga or an 88-year-old guy who ran a marathon. All of that's fine. I think it's really important that people are healthy and actively taking care of their body. But what we are missing often is actively taking care of our soul. And the idea of how does a person deepen their relationship with themselves spiritually and religiously is absolutely part of what happens in the second half of adult life. There's lots of avenues. You can go to church or synagogue or temple or whatever. There's lots of things you can do, but there's not as many paths for someone 65 years old to say, I really want to go on a soul journey to understand who I am and why I'm here on earth and what my legacy is, or to quote Eric Erickson, a developmental psychologist, I am what survives me. What is it that I want to do with my next 20 years between 65 and 85 to create that sense of legacy? There are not a lot of legacy schools. The best legacy you can have is probably impacting the people around you, your family, friends, etc. But people want more than that sometimes. I love what Mark Friedman at Encore created with Experience Corps that now AARP runs, which is how you get older people back into the schools to help younger people. With a world where we're living longer, the question is how do we create some real value? I think the two things people want later in life is curiosity and utility. So curiosity, we've talked about. Utility is like, I want to be useful. It's not just I want to have an impact, but I just want to be useful. Literally, I just want to be able to do something that makes me feel useful. When people lack curiosity and utility, these are the things that accelerate the process of your demise.
Looking back on your life now, are there a couple life lessons you'd care to share with us?
Let me start with a quote, supposedly came from Socrates, and I think there's a real relevance to it, mostly because it's just so poetic. He said, the meaning of life is to find your gift. The purpose of your life is to give it away. What does that mean to me? It means that hopefully over the course of your lifetime, you find that unique talent that you have that is unusual in the world. And it doesn't have to be in your career. If the meaning is to find it and then the purpose is to give it away, then you spend the first half of your life finding it. And maybe the second half of your life, these numbers don't matter. You can spend 80% of your life finding it and the last 20% giving it away. But the giving it away piece is the key. And giving a gift can be just as joyous and maybe more so than actually receiving it.
Anything else?
One of the things that's true as we get older is the first half of our life is about accumulating stuff, relationships, children in our lives, job titles, money. And the second half of our life is about editing. So we move from accumulating to editing. We do something at MEA called the Great Midlife Edit, where people actually spend about 24 hours preparing for this to come up with the things that are no longer serving them that they just need to get rid of. And they end up at a fire on the beach at sunset where they throw a piece of paper in the fire that says, this is what I'm letting go of. I think that those of us who are, say, 45 or 50 years old or older, better learn how to edit our lives. Because if you actually are running the midlife marathon, which sociologists now say lasts 40 years from 35 to 75, midlife used to be 20 years long, now it's 40 years long. If you're running the midlife marathon and you're not editing, you're carrying a lot of baggage on that marathon.
What do you mean by editing?
Editing is thinking about what mindsets, what ways of being, what roles in your life you have that don't serve you. Let's say you are the helper and you are always helping everybody else, but never helping yourself. Doesn't mean you should just be just brutal and difficult now, but it means that maybe it's a role that actually served you for a while. This is particularly true for women who've had children and now they're an empty nester. It's like, okay, I need to shift. For me at Airbnb, it was like, hey, I was CEO of my own company, grew it to 3,500 employees. I did it for 24 years. Then I'm now reporting to Brian Chesky, who I'm mentoring, but I'm reporting to him and he's 21 years younger than me. I had to throw away my script of Chip the CEO. I needed to now be the CEO whisperer, helping Brian. And I had to right-size my ego because my name was not on the marquee anymore. And when there's going to be articles written about Airbnb, you're not going to read about Chip a lot, even though I was right there behind the scenes helping guide Brian in his role as the founder, co-founder and CEO. So I had to let go of the ego associated with being a high-profile business leader and instead say, okay, I'm no longer the sage on the stage, but I'm really the guide on the side, guiding these folks.
Well, thank you for guiding us towards a better, more inclusive world, Chip, and for sharing your insights and experience. It was great to have you on the show.
Yes. Thank you, Colin.
So what did we learn from our conversation with Chip? As it turns out, a lot. Here's my top 10 list. Number one, we learned that long life learning is different than lifelong learning. Lifelong learning is the overall umbrella, but someone who's interested in a long life learning is interested in the kinds of things that are important to them in midlife and beyond. Number two, we also learned that the importance of having a mentor or being a mentor, whether in the workplace or in the school system, is vital because young people and older people have a lot to learn from each other. And if experience is more valuable than money, maybe the future of the organizational world is to marry young, brilliant employees with modern elders who are curious as they are wise. Number three, we need more mainstream programs that help people to understand the process of shifting into midlife and beyond. An example of this is helping young boys and men to better understand their emotions. Number four, in business, we need a merchant sense, a sense of how to make money while incorporating some meaning in the process. Number five, Conley sees having a pioneering spirit to be a great value, enabling him and us to have a meaningful legacy. And the best legacy of all is impacting the people around you, your family, your friends, etc. Remember, the meaning of life is to find our gift. The purpose of life is to give it away. Number six, curiosity is the elixir of life, and it lubricates the heart, the mind, and the soul. Curiosity fuels creativity and innovation and is vital to a growth mindset in later years. So, be curious and fascinated by life and things. Become a first-class noticer, observing life's patterns, because wisdom is all about pattern recognition. And the longer you've been on this planet, the more patterns you're going to see. Make curiosity part of your culture. Number 7, create and invest in a culture that supports wisdom workers. It's not just about the HR department trying to figure it out. It's about everyone in the company figuring it out. Number 8, every 2 years, study a topic that you know nothing about, but be passionately curious about that topic and want to become one of the world's leading experts on it. Number 9, the first half of our life is about accumulating stuff, relationships, children in our lives, job titles, money. And the second half of life is about editing. Editing is thinking about what mindsets, what roles in your life you have that are no longer serving you well, and how to edit those out. And then, of course, my favorite, number 10, embrace your Baja Aha moments. So that's what we learned today from Chip Conley. I hope you choose to share this podcast with others who could benefit from it. And I want to thank each and every one of you for spending time with us today. If you have any comments or suggestions, send me an email at colinmilner@rethinkaging.co. On our next show, best-selling author, innovator, speaker, and surgeon, Dr. Vonda Wright will be on the show. So be sure to tune in. Until then, much success.